over again. Work like a soul inspired till the battle of the day is won. You may be sick and tired, but you'll be a man, my son. Don't you remember the famous men who had to fall to rise again? They picked themselves up, dust themselves off, and start it all over again.
Of the GLEADA Planning Commission, and if you would please all rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. You can all be seated. And Madam Clerk, would you do our roll call, please?
Commissioner Daniels?
Present.
Commissioner Fuller?
Present.
Commissioner Maynard?
Present.
Vice Chair Jenkins?
Here.
Chair Onan?
Here.
Thank you.
All right, so the first item we're gonna address is a public forum, and that's an opportunity for the public to come forward and speak on any item that's in the jurisdiction of the City of Goleta that's not on tonight's agenda. And I do not believe I have any speaker slips. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chair Onan.
All right, so that's the opening of the public forum. Without any request to speak, we'll close the public forum. And we'll move into our next item. So do we have any amendments or adjustments?
We do not.
None. All right, Madam Clerk, let's read our first item. Get right to it.
Item A1 is a public hearing on the Verizon Wireless Streetlight Cell Site, Evergreen Terrace West, located on the north side of Cathedral Oaks Road within the city's right-of-way, approximately 160 feet east of Brandon Drive and adjacent to 7580 Cathedral Oaks Road, APN 079-580-007, case 15-095 CUP.
Thank you.
085 CUP.
All right, who's presenting for the staff?
Good evening, Chair, Commissioners. We'll just get straight started. I have a real quick presentation, and then we'll have the applicant speak and get going. So the project location is here on the map. Cathedral Oaks runs east-west, as we know, and Brandon north-south. It's just 160 feet to the east of the intersection of Cathedral Oaks and Brandon Drive. And the Evergreen Terrace condominiums that were mentioned in the title are here. So just a bit of background. A CUP is required for this project pursuant to the city's telecommunications regulations. And under the California Public Utilities Code, Verizon does have a statewide franchise to place telephone equipment within the public right-of-way. And just another final bit of background, this area and basically the whole western end of Goleta is covered by an existing wireless facility at the Bacara. So this is an existing coverage area. Okay, so the project you'll see on the screen consists of a small cylindrical wireless facility mounted onto a replacement street light owned by Southern California Edison. The replacement street light to be installed by Edison will be in the same location as the current street light shown there. The antenna will be mounted within a 24-inch diameter flush mounted shroud, which will be painted to match the color of the streetlight. And the maximum height of the streetlight with the antenna shroud will be 27 feet 8 inches tall. The associated ground mounted equipment will be located just adjacent there, and enclosed with screening that will have some sort of a green screen on the outside to blend it in with the surrounding landscaping. So a bit about necessity. So if you notice in your packets, the necessity case that the applicant provided on big page 41, you'll notice that the coverage maps before and after are nearly identical. This is because the project is intended to increase the existing service capacity rather than increase the coverage area. So that's an important point to notice there. By increasing the service capacity, it will address growing deficiencies in bandwidth for data transfers, as seen on the graph on the screen, and also on big page 40. And the use of the small streetlight mounted antenna would also reduce the need for a larger installation in the area. And just real quick, I can zoom in on this if it's hard to see, but the horizontal line is basically the capacity of the site that's currently at the Pecara, and then the diagonal line is the projected increase in data use in the area. So very shortly, if not already, it will exceed the capacity of the existing site at the Pecara. So a little bit on general plan consistency. The general plan has three primary goals with regards to telecommunications facilities within the city. They are to ensure compliance with development standards to prevent and minimize effects on visual resources, minimize the need for new separate facilities, and improve cellular service in the city, all of which the project accomplishes. Visual resources are maintained by the use of the small antenna rather than a larger traditional antenna array. The antenna shroud will be flush mounted, as I mentioned earlier, to the streetlight and painted to match. And the ground mounted equipment will be enclosed with a green screen. The project will be conditioned to return to the design review board for final details and design review approval. This project utilizes a streetlight rather than erecting a separate facility, and the project will facilitate improved capacity for the existing service area. Briefly on zoning consistency analysis, as outlined in the zoning consistency attachment of the staff report, the project complies with all applicable requirements of the city's telecommunications ordinance, as well as complies with the maximum permissible exposure limit as established by the FCC. The project will be subject to all applicable post-development requirements per the city's ordinances, including continued emissions compliance and continued compliance with development standards and aesthetic compatibility. And then real briefly on CEQA, the CEQA exemptions that are seen on the screen there. The project will involve installation of a small antenna on a Edison streetlight and replacing an existing streetlight in the same location within the city's right-of-way. It is found consistent with these exemption categories and therefore exempt from further CEQA review. So therefore, staff's recommendation is to adopt the resolution to approve the CUP as the findings can be made subject to conditions of approval. And so that ends staff's presentation. I can take any questions if you've got any.
Thank you very much. So my plan is to get to the public and allow them to speak, but if you have questions you would want to go to before we hear from the public, I'm fine with that as well. Okay, so I am going
Excuse me, Chair. Can you do do your ex parte communications or site visits or anything like that?
That would be very nice. Thank you. Does anyone have anything to any statements to make on site visits or ex parte communication?
I have none for this agenda item.
Mr. Fuller?
None also.
I have none. Mr. Jenkins?
I drove past the site.
Mr. Daniels?
None. Thank you.
All right. So let's go to the public. So we have a few speakers here tonight on this item. That's item A1. I'll call you up. You have 3 minutes. Should you need additional time, let me know. And at the chair's discretion, we would allow you additional time. Rochelle Rose will be our first speaker, and Sandy Kovanda will be our second. And this will not count as your time, Rochelle. All right, we'll take a moment here and see if we can get this operating. There we go. Technical difficulty solved.
Okay. Good evening, Chairman Onan and commissioners. My name is Rochelle Rose. I live at 7560 Cathedral Oaks Road. I've been a Goleta resident for 45 years or more, and I've lived here for 6 years. I have no idea why staff would approve something like this. It's in a densely populated area. We have 36 units there and approximately 150 people living right where you want to put it. I actually, my unit will actually look at it all the time, which is not what I intended when I purchased the property. Our homeowners association, all 36 of us and our neighbors are against it. If you could move it up the street where there's virtually, it's rural, there's no residents, it's not just our complex, as you can see here, and I also brought some photographs, there's building after building of 36 units. So I think you could, there's a lot of open space in between the Bacara and Brandon, and I think it's your duty to find an alternative site. And I hope that you all take the chance to drive by it, and you're welcome to come to my place and see what I'll be looking at. Does anyone have any questions from a resident?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Sandy Kovanda, followed by Michael Issa.
Hello, my name is Sandy Kovanda, and I was at the design review board, and I talked about RF radiation from the cell site, but I have a lot of things that I think that the board should consider to reject this proposal. So I wrote three different emails that are in the attachments here, and I just wanted to circle a few of them. First of all, our CCNRs, our official documents, show that we own the land where the equipment cabinet is going to be located, so it's on private property. I have official documents to prove that, but we have a 3-foot easement agreement with GTE and Edison. Anyways, that's probably why they think it's a right-of-way, but the right-of-way is on the sidewalk. I believe that by putting in this stuff here, I think it's going to lower our property values because it doesn't look very good. It's called a scenic corridor. The Santa Barbara Marathon and AIDS Ride has gone through this corridor before. Besides that, I was looking at all these visual and historic resource element, and I went through all of them and I listed it. But one is you're not supposed to have within 2 mile separation for visible facilities. So that's one of the, it's under Planning Commission Resolution Number 16, Attachment 1, Exhibit 2. And if you look at the VH 4.8G, it also says location of wireless communication facilities within or adjacent to residential uses is discouraged. So that's in your documentation. Also, it talks about light pollution for residents and sensitive to wildlife and migrating routes. We have swallows that come to our building every year to nest. And I guess I just wanted to say that somebody could put graffiti on that wall. I don't want graffiti. And besides that, oh, when you do the RF calculation, somebody put down 35 feet to the nearest residence. If you look at the hill in front of it, there's kids that play on that hill, and it's only 20 feet away. Besides that, the second floor is at the same level as where the radiation goes straight across, so I believe that the RF would be too high, so it should be recalculated, and it's in my email. So also, if we're gonna, if we have a fire or an earthquake and we have to rebuild, if you have that there, we can't change where our buildings are. We can't add to the first, there's a single story right there, we can't add to it. So you're putting restrictions on private property. So all of those things, I would hope you would reject this proposal at this location. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Issa.
Good evening. My name is Michael Issa, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk. So I am a property owner also at this property that is physically right, just right behind that retainer wall there. I have had the opportunity to review the application, and I have two main concerns. While I appreciate the applicant minimizing the antenna size and location, my two main concerns are dealing with this 5 foot tall retainer wall that's going to be placed right in front of the property. To address these, I addressed these in the design review board on February 9th and asked them to explore and minimize the visual impacts. And see if there's somehow you can put this thing underground. Unfortunately, the planning the staff only states that underground is not feasible, yet no evidence was presented to justify why that would be the case. My second concern is the project, as was stated earlier by the other resident, this is on a scenic corridor, and having a 5 foot wall, retainer wall, even if you paint it green, doesn't seem very scenic to me. So it's not really consistent with the city's general plan due to its visual impacts. This project also consists of a substantial change in the existing facility. And so I'm wondering if this new FCC rules that have come out also apply are consistent with this project. I'm aware that the city of Santa Barbara has recently had to update their zoning code for these type of facilities, and would like to see if this is compliant with those rules. Due to these concerns, I would ask for alternative locations, specifically underground locations, to be addressed for this proposed project. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, so I don't have any other speaker slips on this item. Is that correct? Would you? Okay, so let's go back to staff and see if there's anything there that you specifically would like to address that was brought up in public comment.
Chair, commissioners, not at this point. I think that the applicant probably would want a chance to present as well, but staff doesn't have any response at this point.
All right, so I don't see that on my agenda, but you did mention it earlier. So who is it that we have presenting for the applicant?
Ms. Melissa Samarin is here. Hopefully I got that name right.
good afternoon. My name is Melissa Samarin. I'm here representing Verizon Wireless for this project at Cathedral Oaks Road. And I do want to thank staff. They worked with us, you know, in this project and moving it forward. And I just wanted to address a couple of the questions and comments that have been raised thus far. We are FCC compliant. We did issue a EME study that's in the case file, and that was conducted by a third-party vendor who does use the FCC regulations, and this is completely compliant with the FCC regulations. We made sure of that. And the other thing, that there is a condition of approval in the conditions of approval that states that, you know, this project will be reviewed every 5 years for FCC compliance. So that, you know, we are fully accepting of that. And in terms of the visibility of the equipment, we looked at several different equipment options. We did investigate undergrounding and putting the equipment in a vault. And I did submit something to the planner, I believe, last week, and I don't know if it made it in the case file, but it's not going to be feasible for this particular site. There are currently SCE power lines that run underneath the sidewalk at this location, and due to the way that these small cell facilities operate, we have to have a meter pedestal above ground, and there will need to be vent stacks. Even if it was feasible, it's not feasible to have all the equipment undergrounded, and specifically at this site because of those power lines. SCE is not in favor of us messing with their power lines and trying to vault this equipment. So we did look into that that alternative. It wasn't feasible. So I did provide the planner several different options for the equipment. So we can lower the wall, we can, you know, remove the green screen and just have it a plain wall, we can put green screen around three sides. We are willing to work with the design review board or the planning commission on however they think it would be best to screen this equipment. And I think the only other concern that Verizon has for this particular project is with regards to item 19 and the conditions of approval. And that actually speaks to the indemnification language of SCE and the city. And Verizon would like to see that condition, if we move forward with this, they would like to see that condition removed from the conditions of approval, because technically Verizon's not responsible for SCE's actions. And I know there's been some discussion with planning staff and the city attorney, but they would like to see that, you know, removed, you know, because this is a standard SCE project. Verizon's not liable for SCE. We're not comfortable accepting that particular condition of approval. But I would be happy to answer any other questions from staff or the commission.
Any questions for the applicant from the commission?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Hi.
Mr.
Chair, in your evaluation of this area,
sure,
were there any other alternative sites that you had considered?
We did. We looked at several other utility poles along the street. The reason we didn't go into other undeveloped areas is for two reasons. We wanted to avoid having to construct a new structure and you know, further ground disturbance. And secondly, it's important for this site, as the staff explained, this is a capacity site. It's intended to provide additional data capacity and downloading service for the residents in this area. And in order to have that capacity increased, it needs to be located near those residents. So the reason it was selected on, you know, on this road, on the streetlight, was because of its proximity to the residents. We did look at a couple other streetlights. They were deemed not feasible due to constructability issues or leasing issues. They weren't available for Verizon Wireless's use from SCE or constructability. And that's in the alternative analysis that we did provide to staff. But this one was deemed as the least obtrusive means, without having to construct a new structure for this facility, and still remain, you know, as stealth as possible, you know, keeping that in line with the pole and the color, and then of course the equipment. We're trying to keep it as least visually intrusive as possible.
Go ahead, Commissioner Mader.
You said that it needed to be near the residences in order to have the capacity. Can
Correct.
You talk about how near it needs to be to the residences to create the capacity?
Well, as near as possible. We are issued a search ring, and so we look at different sites within that specific radius. So for this specific site, the search ring was, you know, directly around this pole. And, you know, it depends on what the radio frequency needs are. That's issued by the radio frequency engineer. So we looked specifically within this strip along Cathedral Oaks Road, because that's where it was deemed the capacity issue was this specific location. So we looked to be as close to these residents as possible within that search ring.
So I know you said you looked at a number of other sites, and it sounds like maybe staff has the alternative analysis. Is that available public for the public? I know a lot of folks here are interested in alternative options.
It should be.
Mr. Eifeld?
Chair, commissioners, can be made public. I don't have it right here in front of me, but yes.
But it's been available.
Mm-hmm.
As with anything, we sent out a notice. Well, for this item, we did send out a notice in the case file, and it has been available for people if they wanted to come and take a look at it, you know, during business hours. It is available.
All right. Any other questions from the commission to the applicant's representative? Mr. Fuller.
Thank you, Chair. I'll go next. On page 40 in your need case for Evergreen Terrace West, showing the forward data volume.
Mm-hmm.
So my first question is forward data volume a projection or is it factual history?
Let me bring up my case first. Oh, so the forward data volume is the actual volume that is being used, and the projection is that, you know, it will increase, and so that's how they determine the capacity is based on, you know, the actual capacity and the actual volume of data usage versus what, you know, is expected by data trends and the modeling that they have.
Okay, so you're still talking about two different things. You're talking about the historical data versus a projected data.
Correct.
And I don't see any difference here, you know, in the graph. I mean, there's no separation of the two. You can't combine projected with, you know, you can't combine the future with the past, you know, without telling us which is which in a way.
Sure.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, yeah. I don't actually, these come directly from the radio frequency engineer who is not here today. He was at the design review meeting, but and he could speak in more depth about how he came up with these modelings. But, you know, what the graph does demonstrate was that the projected use is projected to increase. And they're seeing an actual increase in usage and a decrease in the capacity to accommodate that usage.
Okay, so what I see is the actual historical use ending in July of 2015. Is that because that's when you made the application and you haven't updated it since?
Correct. And okay. This was generated for the application, which we did submit at the end of July.
All right. Well, then I presume then that the yellow line is the projected forward projection of data usage, the yellow line.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. In making the case here, you know, you don't have any better coverage. And on page 42, you know, from what I can tell from the maps here, it's the, you know, the color maps showing, I believe, the difference in service levels. You know, there's only one little area, you know, in comparison to the whole larger area, it appears that's, you know, essentially going to have better service.
Right, because these maps, the existing and proposed coverage, is this the map that you're looking at?
The next one.
The next one? Oh. This map actually shows the coverage of each of the existing facilities and the proposed facility in that area. So the different colors represent the different sectors that are active in the area.
So they're not levels of service.
No, actually just has to do with the amount of coverage of each of the antenna sectors in the area.
Thank you for clarifying that.
No problem.
You say that the reason why you're proposing this in this area is because, you know, you want to provide better service. So because of the high density that exists there between the condominiums and the apartments down the street, the number of users there, and that's why you're putting it there, is because of the concentration of users.
Correct, yeah, right. Especially specifically in this residential neighborhood.
Right, because of the high density, you're trying to provide additional data coverage.
And help offload the existing sites, as the staff was referencing earlier.
Okay. So that couldn't be accomplished by going a little further away from this site, you know, and directing your antenna towards this area? You say that there's no other existing structures, but I don't think that these residents would be terribly upset,
sure,
you know, if you provided a light pole down the street, you know, a quarter of a mile or a half a mile, so that it's not, you know, directly in their front yards.
Right.
Exactly. And although it'd be a new structure, you know, I'm sure you'd do a similar arrangement by putting it on a pole. It might be that you'd have to run a little more wires or a little more electricity to that location, but you would be able to still provide service, you know, that you're intending to provide by this additional a location just a little further away, would you not?
Well, there's two concerns with that. The first is that even if we move it away, we could potentially, I mean, because this is a residential area, it's going to be affecting a different set of residents. So I'm not sure how moving it would necessarily mitigate the entire problem. And the other issue with that is the further away you go from the targeted radio frequency objective, you have to increase the output of the radio, you know, the emissions from the antennas. They have to be stronger antennas, typically a taller structure to reach the location. So it's not just, you know, constructing a pole. It could, I can't project, I don't have the models in front of me, but it would potentially be a much taller pole, a much larger facility. And then I know that with the zoning code, you know, it does not encourage development within the residential zones. We're in the public right-of-way, which is why we propose this in the public right-of-way as well, versus going on a private property and developing on a residential property.
What I'm thinking is down the street on Cathedral Oaks, which, you know, there currently aren't anywhere near as high a density as there are right in these this area right here. This is a high-density area. And, you know, going to the left here, as you can see, you know, to the other side of the apartments, which are essentially the same density as this is, mm-hmm. You could, right there, you know, you could be located
sure.
With a much lower impact than you would if you did it right smack dab in the middle of these complexes. Even if you had to put a higher antenna up, you know, and maybe even higher, you know, strength beams, it's single family residence to the south and agriculture and open space to the north, which, you know, someday might be developed, but it likely will be single family as well, and so therefore a lower density.
Yeah, and I see what you're saying. The problem is if we did go further that way, the target search ring is in the cross section of Cathedral Oaks Road and the what street? Brandon. Thank you. That is the target, you know, that location right there. Those are the residents we're trying to provide additional capacity for. Moving it further to the left or to the west would essentially require a much taller structure. And, you know, I know you were saying that that's not going to be a problem, but it may be a problem for the residents there. I also know that we'd have to comply with height limits and constructing a brand new facility in the public right-of-way. We would ideally like to use an existing light pole if that was the case, and I know that, you know, we don't want to put an additional 15 feet on top of a light pole. We try to keep that as minimal as possible. We can look into that certainly, but I don't know if it's going to necessarily create a least intrusive facility versus the one that we have here, but, you know, we could look into it.
In my opinion, that's only my opinion,
okay.
Taking the antenna out of the view site of
sure.
a large number of residents would be making it less obtrusive, but that's just my opinion.
Sure. Okay.
Is that all, Mr. Fuller?
I'm good. Thank you.
And were there other, Mr. Daniels, did I see or hear you?
Yeah, I'm just wondering about this forward data volume. I'm wondering, is there's a spike that's very high and there's a spike that's kind of low. Everything else is kind of average, let's say. What causes that, do you know?
I know there's a variety of different reasons why there's a spike in usage or not. A lot of it, there's spikes in usage during the day as well. I mean, there tends to be this really high increase about 9 to 10 o'clock at night as everybody's on their phones just before bed, you know, Facebooking or downloading or watching whatever they are on the internet. So I know that there's fluctuations during the day. There's also fluctuations because of, you know, like a sporting event or some kind of national holiday or something where people have more free time to be on their phones. There's a variety of different reasons why data usage fluctuates, and that's part of the reason why we wanted to, or Verizon is seeking to add these additional sites so that when that capacity does increase or fluctuate and as people start to use their cell phones more and more as their primary phone usage and primary internet usage as well, that's part of the reason for this this particular facility as a capacity site.
Thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Yes, thank you. So this area, this residence, this target zone is currently being served by a facility at the Bacara. And can you answer how far is this target from the Bacara and how large is the structure at the Bacara in comparison with this?
I unfortunately can't speak to the Bacara site. I wasn't working on that project. I don't know the details of it, so I don't want to misspeak on that particular site. But I believe it's a little over a mile away, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. And you don't know what the, does staff know what the structure is at the Bacara? Chair and
Commissioners,
is it similar to this?
Yeah, it, no, it's much larger because it, you know, it serves a wide area. And so I haven't actually seen it physically or seen the permit, but when I was there permitting a separate cell facility at the Bacara next door, up on the roof, there are several antennas probably, and I know that there's a whole equipment room that's probably, you know, I wouldn't venture to guess, but a few hundred square feet just for equipment. In addition to probably the permit I was doing, it was at least 40 feet tall, if not more, and then multi-antennas facing in several directions. So quite a bit larger than this.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, and then I'm just curious if you studied the feasibility of locating, if we can have that aerial shot again, there's a cul-de-sac. If you follow Brandon, it crosses Cathedral Oaks. If it was tucked up at the very top of that pocket,
yep.
That's not in front of anybody's windows, and would that serve the area?
We did look at a particular utility pole at that location, actually. Yeah, there is an existing pole on that cul-de-sac that we did look at, and that was our primary option at the first. We were first looking for a facility in this location, and I believe it wasn't leasable per SCE standards. I know it's in the package. I don't have it on the top of my head. I believe we can probably look at that and verify why that wasn't deemed feasible, but I believe it was for leasing standards. But we did look into that particular pole. I can get more details on why it wasn't feasible.
And Chair and Commissioners, I think in addition to that, I think it's because it's behind some buildings. I'm assuming that it would provide coverage issues with blockage, basically, from the buildings. So.
Okay. Yes, Commissioner Maynard.
Thank you. A couple things. There was a question that was asked about whether the terrain was considered and the fact that the houses are up on a hill. Was that considered when they looked at the FCC exposure rates? Do you know that?
Yes, it is. The vendor does look at the terrain and the heights and locations, yeah.
Okay, thank you. And the lamppost, am I correct that it's more than 20 feet away from the residence? That's correct?
Yes, I'm okay. Correct.
And I also wanted to ask, so the lamppost on the sidewalk, what's the difference, what's the distance between the lamppost and the interior side of the sidewalk by the hill?
Oh, I believe the sidewalk, we have it on the plans, the sidewalk is 6 feet, 8 inches, I believe.
I noticed that, but I didn't see a distance between the lamppost and the hill. So if,
sure.
For instance, if somebody's coming by with a wheelchair, is there sort of a large enough space between the lamppost and the interior side?
Chair and Commissioners, I scaled that out on the plans this morning, and it's 4 feet, 7 inches between the back side of the lamppost and the back of the sidewalk.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I think... And are there any new electrical lines that are getting added as a result of this project? I didn't see any.
No, I don't believe so, no.
Okay, thank you. That's all that I had. I have a few questions for staff, but that's all that I had for the applicant.
So Mr. Fuller, is it still for applicant?
Yeah, if I could have another take at this.
Go ahead.
A question. If this were to get approved and you discovered that your equipment has been approved to be placed on private property that you don't have an easement for, what are you going to do?
We've actually verified that that is public right-of-way, and the reason that we moved it at this location is because it was still in the public right-of-way. We are trying to avoid going on the residential property, so...
Okay, so you have that survey.
We have the survey, we have verification.
Okay. And I just wanted to second Commissioner Jenkins' proposal that it be at the end of that cul-de-sac because, you know, A, it's out of sight, B, you know, it's further away from any inhabited structures. You might be able to put a little larger, facility there, even, you know, being out of sight and out of the way, which could provide better coverage for more people and better data opportunities for more people in the future as well. Just a thought.
Thank you. Right. Thank you. Does staff wish to share anything with us as commission as far as with this statewide franchise, with FCC regulation, what is it that we have latitude to do here as a planning commission and really some of the consequence, if you will? I think it's worth some discussion before we get back to the commission, let them ask questions of staff and get into our deliberation here.
Those are definitely parameters we have to work within, and there's a new one that got thrown on us is also the time frames that both the federal government and the state has imposed on wireless antennas, and I believe that's what Mr. Issa might have been referring to, and we are complying we are complying with the FCC regulations regarding time frames too.
And just speak to that completely, time frames to go through the process?
Yes.
So
yes.
Can you give us a quick outline on that?
Sure. There's one set of antennas that cities have 60 days to act on proposals when someone has an existing cell site and they want to make modifications to that. From the day they walk in the door to the time the city is supposed to act on it, that is a 60-day time window. And that includes any time spent on it, including reviewing it for completeness. Then the next set are antennas that are being co-located on an existing facility. So let's say we have an existing antenna, and somebody wants to add on to that antenna, whether it's to increase the height or just add on to the facility. The city has 90 days to work on that. And then in a case where there is a new facility, then the city has only 150 days. And that includes, like I said, that includes any time that we take on completeness review, making sure the application is acceptable for review process, Native American consultation, CEQA review, commission hearings, and the appeal process. All has to be done within whatever of those three time frames are given to us by both the federal government and state.
And what are we working with here?
We are working with the 150-day one, and they did submit in July. The clock stops whenever, we did our completeness review. Whatever time frame that took, those days are gone. And then when the project goes back to the applicant, then the clock stops. And then when they resubmit, then the clock starts again. So we are working on the 150 days. We did, there was a lot of back and forth on this application, and our time frames are getting shorter. but if the applicant would have to be willing to ask for, there's something they we can get is what's called a tolling agreement to stop the clock and to get extra time. But we're trying to work within our 150 days, and we haven't gotten to that point yet.
Okay. Speak to our next two encumbrances, the statewide franchise and the FCC.
The statewide franchise, if they have, we've had this before, if they have a right to use a pole that like SCE has determined a pole to be eligible to be used for antenna. We just know that they have the right to use that pole. It doesn't mean that we have to approve it at this location. It just means that they have the right to use this pole. There's no debate over that aspect of it. But we could, if we determine it's not appropriate, since they need approval from us, we can base our decision, we have to, our CUP findings. If the commission doesn't feel like the CUP findings can be made in some aspect, just because they have a lease agreement or a franchise agreement, that doesn't preclude us from either approving it based on the findings or denying it. And what was the other one?
FCC.
Oh, FCC, we're pretty much preempted. If they've set the standards, and if the applicant, if the proposal complies with the standards, we can't regulate based on that.
And that's associated with
the EMF.
Yeah,
and the RF.
And the analysis of health impacts or whatever is part of that. That is basically within the FCC guidelines.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So thank you very much
for
that rundown.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just have a question too, just follow up. So I'm curious on this timeline aspect, and if the commission, it sounds like we're curious if there's other locations that are possible, what does that do? Is that, are our hands tied in that aspect, or what does that do to the clock? Does that penalize? What happens?
What happens, the clock will still keep running until we get a tolling agreement from the applicant. And if we aren't able to get a tolling agreement within the time frame, then the city could consider denying the project. That's a possibility. We just have to act within the time period.
So the alternative analysis, it wasn't included in our packet as well. I mean, we've had a lot of questions here about alternatives. The applicant has answered some of those questions, but the case documentation and alternatives wasn't included. Is that correct?
Chair, commissioners, correct. Yeah, this was the option that we looked at and took to design review board. So we wanted to continue that to planning commission for review. But yes, it is available as public document as part of the application.
Okay.
Yeah, and we can provide that. Yeah.
So let's go back to the planning commission, and you know what? You can have a seat again, and if we need you back, don't run away. But let's go to the commission, and first let's have and see if we have any questions for staff before we get into the deliberation. Go ahead, Mr. Fuller.
Thank you, Chair. Two questions. One, how many days are left?
I believe the shot clock ends in mid-April.
45 days or so, huh? Okay, thank you. And if we miss the shot clock, what happens?
Project is deemed approved.
As submitted or as it is, sitting in front of us?
As submitted. It's deemed approved.
As submitted, right. Okay. So any modifications that we tried to make in the meantime, do they, is it the latest version or is it the original version? Or?
I believe it's the original version because we haven't approved. It's whatever was submitted.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Maynard? Europe.
Okay, I'll do one related to that. So if we deny the project, that stops the clock, and then could the applicant come back with another proposal looking at the alternative locations?
Yes.
Okay. I have a couple more questions, so I'm going to keep going with this. There seems to be some discrepancy about whether part of this land is on private property, and I didn't know if staff had any comments to confirm right away versus private property.
Yes, and Chair and Commissioners, Ms. Milan is here to kind of explain the city's right away. And Ms. Milan, I do have the road drawing, if you want to go up there and point to it.
Good evening, commissioners and chair. This public improvement plan, if you'll note, is in the bottom kind of right where you can see it shows that it was dated in 1971. This is something that we acquired as we incorporated from the county of Santa Barbara. It shows a 104-foot right-of-way, and you will note that is shown on both the north and south side of the street, which is pretty typical of what we see in the city of Goleta. And in this particular location, there could be what we call coterminous easements. But as far as the city knows, we have a 104-foot right-of-way on Cathedral Oaks, and I have no evidence that tells me that the street was not built in the correct location or in accordance with these plans. So what we would go forward on, the city has not had it surveyed. There's not been a need to survey this as far as I would be concerned, but if there was some discrepancy or some other information that was provided that would show me that this is not where things were built, because they do show streets and intersections, and it seems to be consistent with the median and the other widths that are out there, I would have a pretty strong indication that there is indeed 10 feet. Now, remember, there's the curb, which is 6 inches. There's the sidewalk that's behind that, and then there is a landscape area, which is the area that we have asked that this be constructed in order to continue to facilitate pedestrian access to the maximum that there is out there. So at this point, I feel fairly confident that there is indeed the 10 feet behind the face of curb, and it also kind of works on the other side of the road as it falls into where the wall was constructed for the properties on the other side. So that kind of gives us a sense of you know, what the plans show, what appears to be built seems to be consistent.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I don't have any more questions for you. Thank you.
I do have one.
Oh, sorry.
Before you go. I'm looking at sheet LS-1, which is this guy.
Okay.
And it shows,
got it.
Looks like the wall itself might be encroaching onto the private property versus the vault itself.
Because you you've got big page number on that?
Big page 47, thank you. So if you're 10 feet and the sidewalk is, what was it, 7 foot 10?
Six foot eight. Correct. And I concur that that wall may indeed be on the private property. Whether there is an easement with the utility company that owns it and or not, I don't know. It's nothing that I have investigated. It's an existing situation. There are, unfortunately, many interesting existing situations in the city of Goleta that were approved prior to our incorporation. And as I said, the facilities that they're building are all within the existing 104-foot right-of-way or 10 feet within the face of curb to whatever their improvements are. Now, during the construction of those improvements, if the contractor has to go onto the private property, they do have to obtain what we call a right of entry, although the ultimate work doesn't impact the private property, nor is it on, but sometimes you got to put a piece of formwork in, or you have to dig out a little more in order to build. But that is something that would be on the developer's responsibility, and we would verify that through the encroachment permit process, that they would be required to provide those rights of entry if they have to build it that way. So although this existing vault may have a retaining wall around it that protects it, whether or not there was ever attained an appropriate easement or anything else, I do not know. Mm-hmm. And if it's in conflict, it typically would be an issue between the private property owner and the utility company who constructed it whenever they constructed it, or even now.
Have alternatives been considered to see if there was a way to put that retaining wall inside of the right-of-way as opposed to the private property?
Well, in this particular instance, as I say, it's not something that Public Works would typically step into because it's not our facility. It belongs to, I'm not even sure if it's Southern California Edison or somebody else at this standing here right now, and the property owner. Because if something was done 20 years ago, I don't really have that information available to me.
Thank you. I had two other questions
for
staff.
Go ahead, Commissioner Rayner. Okay.
So this gets into some other elements. So in the general plan, it was pointed out that visual resources 4.8 says the location of wireless communication facilities within or adjacent to residential uses is discouraged. How do we reconcile this between what we're hearing, that these wireless facilities have to be right next to, you know, we're getting an impression tonight that they've got to be right next to the residents in order to get the capacity, but our general plan says that they shouldn't be next to residences. So I'm having trouble understanding which direction we should be going here.
Well, the general plan says that we're discouraged.
Yes.
It doesn't say, I mean, and this is a situation where the antennas, you know, people are using using data and needing the capacity. Mm-hmm. So really, it's a weighing factor. Mm-hmm. How to balance the idea of not having, big wireless telecommunication facilities in neighborhoods, but also people want their cell phones. They want their cell phones to work. They want, if they want to go on the internet. And they don't want to have it slow or not happen. Mm-hmm. So really, it's a balancing. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Ms. Carmen wants to add to that.
Oh no, I was just going to say that the general rule is, while it is discouraged, but the general rule in cell development is the smaller the unit is, the closer it needs to be to its source, and the farther it gets away, it gets bigger, it gets taller. And so this is something that would need to be placed well within a neighborhood in order for it to maintain its small size.
Okay. And then I guess my other question is, so we're hearing this strong pushback from the housing that's right there, while we're also hearing from the applicant that the reason for putting this there is to provide greater service to the folks in that apartment complex. If the folks in the apartment complex are okay with slow speeds and don't want this facility to be there, can we deny it based on the community now, the community that would be served not wanting it?
You can only deny it based on the findings for a CUP. Okay. So you need to look at those findings and decide whether or not you can make them.
Okay. So it would not be connected to local interest. Okay. And then I have one other question. There was a mention about the indemnification language, and I assume council will look at that. I don't have a strong feeling about that. There was a comment from the applicant. Ms. Kai, there was a comment from the applicant about indemnification language on item 19, and I didn't know if you wanted to respond to that. I don't personally have a strong opinion, but I know the applicant had made a request and was curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, the point of having indemnification is for any project is so that the city is not liable for any damage, injury caused by the private developer when they're undergoing the work, the construction, and whatnot. So because this project involves two utilities, one SEE, one Verizon, and Verizon is the party coming in to ask for this project. We asked for Verizon to take on all the risks associated with this project.
Thank you for clarifying that. That's all the questions I had at this time.
All right. Who else from the commission has questions for staff?
Can I just make a few comments?
Well, we'll get into that shortly here. We're going to have a round of deliberations.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I have documentation that proves that it's our private property, and I have the documents with me, so I can show that. So I was wondering if I could speak about that, because we just had somebody showing, and I have the same documents here, but it's from our condominium association, and it proves that the block wall, the equipment cabinet is on our property. As soon as you get off the sidewalk, you're on private property. And if you read, I put it in my email, but if you read my email, it shows that the plans, there's a section in the plans that say that they didn't do a property study, a survey. So anyways, and I have proof that it's our private property, so that equipment cabinet, you know, you can't do that if it's on private property.
We'll hold your research for right now.
Okay.
And let's see where this goes, whether we need to access that or not.
Okay.
But I appreciate you informing me.
And when you're talking about the RF stuff, if you read the email again, it says that, you have to do the terrain, elevation of terrain, that they would recalculate to get the values. And also, if you talk about the 2 mile separation, there's a new plan to put a, wireless cell site by Dos Pueblos that's 3/4 of a mile away from us, so that is closer than 2 miles away. So those are the things that I forgot to say before. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Could we ask staff to respond to the comment about the Dos Pueblos telephone tower and if that's going to be also within the 2 mile range?
Go ahead. Chair, commissioners, I don't have an exact mileage between the two facilities, but it was staff's opinion that this was not a substantially visible antenna, and I think that's the intent of the policy, is that, you know, they want to limit these larger facilities from being very close to each other, rather than these smaller ones.
And yes, there is an antenna. The commission approved it in May or June of last year, and I'm thinking, I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure it's been installed by now.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't, I've driven by, but I haven't really noticed.
All right. So now we're going to go back to the commission. We've supposedly asked all our questions. Now it's deliberation, so it's discussion amongst ourselves. To see where we think we should go. So, Commissioner Fuller.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if I should have asked a question or not, because I'm looking at the page 49, which shows the cul-de-sac, and it doesn't show any light posts there, because I can see where they've noted the light posts on the sidewalk down below at the top. And, you know, if a light, a light was located there, if the residents of these condominium associations wanted to have a street light there, they could probably also have a co-located cell site there, and it would be out of the way of everybody there. I mean, pretty much not visible, and it would also provide light for the entrance to the two driveways, which access the garages there. So that's kind of a comment I would make.
Any other comments from the rest of the commission?
I'm seeing a property boundary going right through the middle of the vault. Just FYI.
Any other comments from the commissioners?
Yep. I'm just with the commissioner. The last comment. I'm not convinced that the retaining wall is not on private property. So, you know, I mean, as many different diagrams as are proposed here, without something certified from a surveyor, I have concern about that. So, I'm sorry.
Could I, for our discussion here, there's several uncertainties that we have identified. Perhaps we could get to a higher level of certainty here, but perhaps not. We also have the discussion here of the alternatives that we didn't have all the exposure there that perhaps we had. Would it be acceptable, and maybe our city attorney could, for us to continue this to a time indefinite meeting, but to be established, unless we can establish a date, and try to clarify some of these details rather than us take a vote up or down on this project at this time?
You can certainly continue it to another date, but just realize it's going to take away time, the 45-day period of the shot clock that we have left.
Well, we'll use as little of that shot clock as we can. But so we're not restricted from that action?
No, you're not.
Go ahead, Commissioner Fuller.
Thank you, Chair. And, you know, could we attempt to negotiate a tolling for some amount of time? You know, I would encourage if the rest of the commission also thinks it's a good idea, you know, for the staff to attempt to negotiate a tolling of the time.
Yes, if the applicant is willing to enter into a tolling agreement, the city attorney's office could draft that tolling agreement up quickly and have it signed.
There is a
a light pole at the top of that cul-de-sac. Oh. I have a picture of it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay, yes, Commissioner Fuller.
Maynard. I fully support the idea of a continuance, and what I would like to see at the next meeting would be a model of a proposal showing how this project could be done without infringing on private property. And so could this project be done where the vault and the retaining wall are outside of the private property area? I would like to see the range maps to show really how close does this have to be to the residences to meet the capacity needs. I didn't feel like I got a clear answer on that today, and I'd like to know what the alternatives considered were. I think that is, and I'd like also a map of where the other telecommunication facilities are and what the distances are between those and this project so we can evaluate the 2-mile separation guidelines in the general plan.
Okay. Does that, anybody else have anything they want to add to that? Or do we have?
Commissioner Jenkins? I would support a continuance because I can't make finding in section 3, number A, that the property is adequate in size. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's adequate in size because the vault appears to be in the right of way, but the retaining wall does not. And location, I can't necessarily make the finding of location from the standpoint that we're just begging for more information as the commission as far as what are some of the alternative sites and what does that mean? You know, the discussion was if it's moved to the left, which is what is that, west, mm-hmm. to in front of more of a rural setting, how much taller does that antenna have to get, you know, to meet it? Because currently this area is being served and the projection is suggesting that it won't be adequate service. But I just feel like we need more information, and I'm having a real tough time making the finding A. So I would support a continuance.
Now, just to make sure, let our city attorney weigh in. Is this the most effective way for us to stall this for a little while?
Yes. We discussed getting a tolling agreement, and we would need someone from Verizon to agree to that.
Right. They'll have to have their discussions outside of this.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may participate in this too, a denial is an option as well.
It is.
Because,
right.
because it would allow them to then seriously look at alternative sites, and then we would get more information. The clock stops. We don't, you know, de facto approval of a project that's right in, you know, where they want it for convenience sake. So if the clock is, if we're really crunched against it and it's not feasible, let's deny it. So then we've got more time.
If you deny the project, they could also appeal, and that appeal to City Council, and that would eat up some of the time with the shot clock as well. Mm-hmm. So the path that was suggested earlier is would give staff enough time to explore the different alternatives and bring back the information that Commission has asked for, which is just. So the path that you suggested earlier would be more efficient, I guess, to continue the hearing so that staff can address some of the issues and get the tolling agreement from the applicant.
I think there's some concern about time because we need to figure in an appeal into the shot clock time. And so depending on how long we were to continue it, we would need to take a quick break and look at calendars and figure that out, just to make sure that we would have enough time to get to council for an appeal, should there be one, regardless of what the decision is on the next meeting. We do have March 7th already reserved. However, I don't know if all of this information could be developed and handed out within the next 3 days.
So yeah, that
it would probably
that would
be too tight.
Very yeah. difficult. But we could, couldn't we just put this on the front end of a zoning agenda. if time requires it, that's what we would have to do. I think we're better trying to keep this within our control.
Sure.
Rather than allow the shot clock to expire.
Oh, no, absolutely. But there are also alternatives that have just been mentioned that also keep the shot clock in our control. It's entirely up to the commission. I just wanted to make that point that if we do want to continue, we do need to take a moment and also make sure that either special meeting or look at the clock and see where we are as far as dates and how far we could go before we talk about doing that.
So I'm not clear. Do you need to do this now?
If the commission would like to continue, I would request a five-minute recess so we can convene as staff and look at a date that would work with the time that we have left remaining on the clock.
Did I see you? Commissioner Fuller?
Thank you. Before we do a check on that continuance and the five-minute recess, I just want to make a couple more quick comments, if I may.
Okay.
One, I noticed that on this map on page 47, it actually is prepared by a licensed land surveyor, and it does show the retaining wall on private property, although the vault is in the right-of-way. And then, again, if the Verizon could work out something with Southern California Edison and use the lamppost at the top of the cul-de-sac, you know, I think it would be far enough out of the way that even in the future, if they wanted to have additional capacity and additional signal strength, it would be far enough away from residents that they could provide better service for a wider area as well. So thank you.
Okay, so what we have, I believe, is the concept of a continuance.
Recess.
Recess first? Wow, I missed that whole part. Okay, so before we look for motion, we're going to have a quick five-minute recess. So that puts us back here at 7:15. Yes. All right, so our five-minute recess is up. We're going to call the meeting back to order. We got everybody engaged here. So what I've been informed from the staff is that they will find a time for this to continue on through the process. Should we decide to continue it? So now it's up to the commission to make a motion on what we want to vote on. So.
Well, if staff could just note that the timeline does not work for a straight continuance. It will only work with a tolling agreement, which we've been informed Verizon will consider. If for some reason we cannot come to an agreement with them, we will bring it back to you for a denial or whatever else you would like to do with it within that time period, yes.
Okay. So does that make sense to everyone on the commission? Yes, Commissioner Mayne.
So does that work that if we continue it tonight but we don't get a tolling agreement, we'll still have an opportunity to consider a denial and still have time for an appeal? I guess I'm wondering if they appeal it, would we end up in a situation where it would get automatically approved because of the appeal?
There is that possibility. We would bring it back to you at the first available meeting if a tolling agreement cannot be agreed to, and that would be March 14th.
Okay.
So we've got a couple weeks to work that out.
Okay. And if the appeal kicks in, then how much longer would that potentially take?
If the appeal kicks in, we would immediately need to flip an application or a report to council for consideration on April 5th.
Okay. And that's possible that we could get to council on April 5th?
It would be really, really tight.
Okay.
And we'd probably have to make some room. But yes. I mean, for an appeal, they need to hear it and they understand that there's a time clock.
Okay. Thank you. That helps me to understand what the options are.
Motion.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion. First of all, I want to thank staff and look forward to more input on this. So, and thank you for everybody trying to work on this. Appreciate it. I move that we continue item A1 to a future date.
There's a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Looks unanimous to me. Okay. So we move on. All right, Madam Clerk, will you read our next item, which is item A2?
Item A2 is also a public hearing. It's on PRC 421 Access Road Maintenance and Repair Project APN's 079-210-059 Sandpiper Golf Course and 079-210-042 Elwood Onshore Facility, case number 15-004-DP and 15-003-CDP.
Thank you. All right, and it looks like we have staff presenting for us. Ms. Wells?
Just give us a second here.
Okay.
Good evening, Chair and Commissioners. Tonight's hearing is in regards to Venico's application for after-the-fact permitting for unpermitted repair work on an existing access road, and also for authorization for 5 years of repair and maintenance on an existing access road. As you'll see in the presentation, the access road connects Hollister Avenue in Western Goleta and the Elwood Onshore Facility to State Lease 421 piers and two piers and two wells. One's a water injection well, and one is an oil well. And the property is that the road exists on is owned by Sandpiper Golf Course, and it is zoned, and the land use designation is recreation. So the purpose of the road is to serve the oil and gas use, which is a legal non-conforming use in the recreation zone. That said, that facility, the piers, the wells, the road has been there for a really long time, before the California Environmental Quality Act, so we don't have an environmental document to use as a resource. It was also before the Coastal Act, so there's no coastal development permit. And I think pretty much it was before most regulations. So there's really no permits that for us to use as resources. And this would be our first opportunity, or probably I think any agency, to have oversight of the repair and maintenance of the access road. Tonight's presentation will be provided to you by Jerry Hittleman. He is from Rincon Consulting, and they did the environmental document that's in your packet. And he knows, you know, he's been working with the agencies and the applicant on this item, so he can give you a great presentation. I wanted to also clarify, you have two public comment letters that were provided in the last few days. They're on the dais, and they're also at the public counter. I think most of the questions are going to be answered in the presentation. We tried to address as many as we can in the presentation. So with that, I will just turn it right over to Mr. Hittleman, and he will guide you in on this project. And also wanted to emphasize this is a public hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Thank you, Ms. Wells. Honorable Chair and Commissioners, the item before you tonight is a access road maintenance and repair project for PRC 421. And we'll start out with the vicinity map. The project is located south of Highway 101. It enters the Elwood Onshore Facility on the west side of the facility, comes along the west side along the fence, and then enters the Sandpiper Golf Course, and then continues actually through a portion of the golf course, and then is on the south side of the golf course between the beach and the bluffs that are below the golf course until it reaches the PRC 421 and 422 piers, which you see are located on the eastern end of the access road. And we'll have some more detail on that eastern end and show you where the piers are and where the road is. When the road does enter the golf course property, it's on a 20-foot to 40-foot easement and continues, and the road is pretty much an average of 12 feet in width and there is a rock revetment between the road and the beach and the ocean that we'll see, and that varies in width from about 10 to 20 feet. And we'll see also that the bluffs are about 20 to 50 feet on the north side of the access road. So let's go to the jurisdictional boundaries, which are very interesting for this project. The road itself is located in City and Coastal Commission jurisdiction. When you look on the photo to the right, the red line shows the boundary between what we call the mean high tide line, which shows the jurisdiction between what is the city to the north or to the right, and the Coastal Commission and State Lands Commission jurisdiction, which goes out into the ocean and actually includes the piers themselves. So the road is City and Coastal Commission jurisdiction. The piers themselves are within State Lands and Coastal Commission jurisdiction. So it's quite an unusual situation. And then we have, just wanted to also point out that the city has been working very closely with the Coastal Commission staff, not only our permit, but their permit that you'll see is going on March 9th to the full Coastal Commission. We worked on conditions, impacts, and so forth with them. So we're totally in alignment with the Coastal Commission and their staff on this project. Here are some pictures of the road. The picture on the left is standing on the road looking towards the Elwood Onshore facility and the gate toward, which is to the golf course is in the far end of the photo. To the left or to the south is the revetment. You can see that it's a rock revetment. It's been there for a long time, like Ann said, since the 1920s, been repaired quite often. And then the bluffs are to the right. Again, they're 20 to 50 feet in height. Photo on the left, again, shows the access road, but you can see the entrance to pier number one, 421 number one, and that is to the left. And again, the road maintains about a 12-foot width in this location, and we do have the bluffs. The photo on the right is actually standing on one of the piers, looking at what's called the causeway, which connects, it's a little bridge that goes over to the pier, made out of wood. And we're looking at a berm and then a drainage area with some wetlands. And those wetlands are protected by that small berm. And the wetlands are not part of this project. As you'll see, we've gone to great measure to try to protect those wetlands during any repair and maintenance activity. So that's one thing we really wanted to emphasize in this project. This is a photo from actually 1938, shortly after when the oil field was discovered and all the wells were put in. And on the far upper left-hand corner, or probably towards the middle of the left-hand side of the slide, is where these two piers are. They're the only two piers that are left after of all these facilities that were out there in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. And as the field was used up, they took away some facilities, but these are the only two that are left. And Bacara Resort would be up on the top end of the slide as we're looking at it now. Of course, the golf course is on the right. The fields and the road have a long history, but what I'm going to do is just focus in on from 2001 to present and what has been done on the road. And the reason for that is because that's when the city took jurisdiction of the road. Before that, it was in the county, and they did their own permitting or whatever they needed to do, but we're just going to focus in on what we need to permit, which is what has occurred since 2001, 2002 era to present, and then into the future for the next 5 years, looking at what kind of activities can occur and how they will occur to maintain and repair this roadway. So in 2001, 2002, there was an emergency permit issued by the county. This was due to some storms and some damage that was done to the road. 2004 and 2010, there was work done to repair not only parts of the road, but mainly this was a caisson project to protect the wells themselves. So you see around the wells in the picture in the bottom, they're in the near shore. They are subject to wave action, and we needed to allow some caissons to be built around those and the road to be improved a little bit to protect the wells and really improve the access to the roadway. 2005 to 2008, some minor road repairs. 2012 and 2013, again, some maintenance was performed on the road, and then there was a winter storm in 2014 that required some more major work on the road.
Just a quick question there. The caisson repair 2004, 2010, was that a permitted activity via the Coastal Commission?
Yes, it was actually approved by the Coastal Commission and the city, I believe.
And the city was in?
The city council or the planning commission also approved that project for repairs. So for it was just for a limited time, though.
Okay, thank you.
So that brings up the need for the project. And as you can see, the state and city permits related to the PRC 421 lease facilities are needed to allow daily access to the two existing 421 piers and wells. One is an oil extraction well, and one is a water injection well. So for different purposes, they need to be looked at on a daily basis, make sure they're in operating condition. And the road is constructed at the base of the bluff over the beach. So it's actually over the beach, it's not over the bluff, and is subject to wave and cliff erosion, as you know. And project purpose is to maintain the access road to allow for daily well monitoring, visual inspection, and also emergency access. There might be emergencies out there. We don't want to see any leaks or any disasters on the beach or into the ocean environment. So that's very important for this project. The approval of the past activities, 2001 through 2014, is part of the project, and describe those. They had some were related to the caissons, some were maintenance and typical repair projects, small repairs. And again, the future periodic maintenance of the road is for a 5-year period. Future activities will include standard maintenance and repair to include the following components: to perform routine and typical storm maintenance as described, repair potholes in the roadway created by runoff, and repair or replace riprap lining the access road only landward of the existing location. Nothing can go towards the ocean or seaward of its existing location. So it's just to actually pick up the rocks from the roadway using crane or various equipment and put it back into place. So really, we're just looking at the external parts of the roadway. It's the top surface and the rock revetment. There are some pipes and other infrastructure underneath the roadway. That's not part of this project, just looking at the surface. And the equipment will be brought from off-site and temporarily stored on the Elwood onshore facility if needed. It's supposed to come to the site fully fueled, so we'll have very little refueling, if any, for the temporary maintenance of the roadway. And the equipment proposed to be used during maintenance and repair activities is a front-end loader, rubber-tired track excavator, and a dump truck, as you see in the picture. And that's just to put any material back onto the surface. It has about a 3-inch road base, and that's all we're looking at. And any potholes will be filled also. And again, the rock revetment. This is a survey that was done of the road, and the only thing that's really important to point out on the survey, again, you can see right over here is where the mean high tide line is, or the high water mark, and that separates the jurisdiction of the city and the Coastal Commission and the city and the State Lands Commission. It's this portion of the roadway is on the Elwood onshore facility, and then it goes into about a 20 to 40 foot easement all the way to the piers. And again, maintains a 12 foot width the entire way. This figure is on the far eastern end of the roadway alignment. And as you can see, this is the pier at the far eastern end. And we looked at a picture that showed the wetlands in this area. And the wetlands would be protected by a small berm. And what the purpose of this figure is, it's a little confusing, but it shows that there is enough room here and the proper radius for equipment to turn onto the pier and make that maneuver. There will be absolutely no activity on the beach allowed, nothing, no equipment. Might have some people on the beach observing where the rocks go, but no mechanical equipment at all on the beach. So the purpose of this is not to show vehicles on the beach, but to show that you can make the turning radius onto the pier. We did prepare a draft initial study, mitigated negative declaration, and this was circulated for the required 30-day review, October 30th through December 4th, 2015. The final MND, including response to comments and a mitigation monitoring and reporting program, was released a couple weeks ago on February 17th. And the city and the Planning Commission, you must consider the MND pursuant to CEQA at today's hearing. So that's one of the required findings. We did do a thorough analysis of all the various categories. We looked at aesthetics. In that category, or environmental issue, we looked at temporary construction impacts that are related to equipment just being on the road. People might see it from the beach, but it'll be a temporary of nature. There are no agriculture or forestry resources in this area, so no impact. Air quality, all emissions are temporary, again, temporary construction related, and they are, we have various conditions and APCD measures that the applicant will be required to meet. That's the Air Pollution Control District for Santa Barbara, and they are very strict in terms of not only dust control, having water trucks and so forth, but also on diesel engines. If there's any diesel engine, it must be tuned, it must meet their standards. So we're confident that they will be way below any standards or thresholds for APCD. Biological resources, I'll talk about that in a little more in more detail. We have some other figures that'll show that. And that is the one issue where we do have some impacts and mitigation, but I'll talk about that in more detail. Cultural resources, no impact. This is totally a man-made facility, and there's no natural or untouched ground that would be touched by this project. Geology and soils, there is seismic activity and there are faults in the area, but we're not putting in any new structures, and this structure has been here since the 1920s. There's been various earthquakes during that time. Might be some sloughing off the bluff, but that's why we're doing the project. So that can be removed so equipment can go back and forth on the road. We did look at greenhouse gas emissions, again, temporary construction impacts, similar to air quality impacts. So no impact in that category. Hazards and hazardous materials. The only hazardous material would be fuel for the equipment, and that's going to be strictly regulated by this project. So don't anticipate any impacts. We don't know of any hazardous materials that are being used or out on the road right now. Hydrology and water quality, there is no impervious surfaces. This will be a dirt roadway, so all the water can infiltrate into the soil. We won't be creating any urban pollutants. And there's no expansion of use. We're not going to allow them to expand this road in any manner or enlarge it in any manner as part of the project. And there'll be, should be no erosion impacts, although potholes might form, and that would be the only small erosional impacts we could see. Land use and planning, I should point out that there's, this project will not be near any housing, will not physically disrupt any community. And it, I'll show consistency of this project with the zoning ordinance and with the general plan. Mineral resources, of course, the one mineral resource here is the oil and gas potentially to come out of these wells. They're right now inactive, but that's all we're looking at in terms of mineral resources, no impacts to them. Noise, there will be some noise, temporary noise impacts from the equipment, but we don't, have any sensitive noise sources near this facility or the roadway. There are some new housing developments that were pointed out in the public letters. We put them into our analysis, and they're a half mile or more away from the facility. There'll be no impacts. Under population and housing, again, we're not looking at any impacts to population or housing because they're not proposing any new residences or affecting any existing residences. Public services, there is the Elwood School, which is about 4,000 feet away. There's a fire station within about 2 miles, and then the sheriff's substation in our building, which is about 2.5 to 3 miles away. So it is served by public services. There'll be absolutely no impact to those services themselves. And then recreation, the road is on the beach, but there is plenty of room for the public and to access the area to the south of the roadway, and they do. There's jogging, there's beach activities in this area, and there's no enlargement or expansion of this use, so we see no impacts to that category. And then transportation and traffic, again, temporary impacts. We'll be seeing the construction equipment come to the site and be stored on the site temporarily, and it won't have a significant impact on traffic in this area. And then utilities and utility services, there's no impact to water use, will not be increased, or wastewater usage as well. So we don't see any impacts to any utilities or utility services. So again, the one remaining issue is biological resources, and we did identify that as a potential impact, and we do have some mitigation. As you can see, the project is next to the EOF facility, and there is Bell Canyon over here with creek that runs through the middle of it. And also we do have the bluffs, which have sensitive habitat. Now, the access road is located basically on a sage scrub, dune bluff scrub habitat, which is designated as environmentally sensitive habitat area, also known as ESHA, by the city and the Coastal Commission. And the Goleta General Plan and the California Coastal Act require strict protection of ESHA against significant disruption of the habitat. We'll show how that's going to be done. There is salt brush scrub and coastal submarsh and coastal bluff scrub species are predominant plants associated with in the vicinity of the access road. And those are associated with the wetlands. I showed you one wetland. Now I'll describe that there's actually that's the major wetland on the eastern end, and then there's two smaller ones towards the west side. And the three wetland sites are supported by mainly seeps and are located along the toe of the bluff immediately adjacent to the access road. And you'll see that they do support some sensitive species. The species of concern, some of which are threatened or endangered, are the tidewater goby, the red-legged frog, and the monarch butterfly. So we do have some sensitive species out there that need to be protected. Again, there's no expansion or enlargement of the road. And we do have some mitigation measures. I point out that we have biology one, which is protection of sensitive habitat. And that basically relates to putting up silt fences, having an environmental monitor on site at all times, a biological monitor to make sure that no species, whether plant or bird or animal, will be protected. And then also protection of nesting birds if there are birds nesting in the area during nesting season, they will be protected through the use of the biological monitors. And in addition to the mitigation measures and conditions, I'd just like to go highlight some of the main ones. We're going to have a pre-construction meeting prior to any maintenance or repair activities on the site. Again, environmental monitors, one will be a qualified biologist. No mechanical equipment will be allowed on the beach. No equipment washdown or refueling on the access road. That would only occur within the EOF facility. Have strict dust control measures in conformance with air pollution control district conditions and our mitigation, our conditions as well. Sensitive species protection surveys and measures, again, for the tidewater goby, red-legged frog, God bless you, and the monarch butterfly. And then also exclusionary fencing to protect the adjacent habitats, especially the wetlands, will be used during these activities. Did get a number of public comments, actually 8 during public review. And let's see. We did get a letter from the State Clearinghouse saying that no state agencies had any comments on the project. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers basically said that they will not require any permits, Department of Army permits, for the repair and maintenance activities. If they came in with another project that were to encroach on the wetlands or any of the sensitive habitat, yes, then they'd have to get a permit, but not for this project. The Air Pollution Control District, again, outlined all their measures, which are very strict to control air quality, and those have been incorporated into the project. The Fire Department had no comment. We did get Barbara Massey had some concerns, and her concerns basically had to do with past repair work. While we're permitting that, composition of the road base, which has been described, just the top surface, 3 inches, and then the rock revetment, riprap. The equipment laydown area, she was concerned that that might be an ESHA. It will not be an ESHA. It will be totally within the fenced area of the EOF on previously disturbed areas. And then we have wetland mapping. We showed only one wetland in the MND, the mitigated neg deck, but there are two others that I described. Those are smaller seeps, and we know where they are, and they will be protected definitely during any maintenance activities. To get another letter from Dr. Inga Cox, and again, she was concerned about the composition of the road base, instability of adjacent coastal bluffs. And you can probably see on some of those figures, there is some sloughing that comes off those bluffs, and that will be removed during these maintenance activities. Potential impacts to residents within a half mile. We did take a look at the bluffs and the hideaway development, the Elwood School, and we determined that there will be no impacts to those facilities. ESHA impacts, again, we are protecting the ESHA. Condition of the seawall. The seawall will need to be repaired on a periodic basis. So that would just be placing rocks back in place periodically. And then potential beach impacts, which we think will be very temporary, and again, all equipment will be focused only on the roadway itself. Did get a letter from the State of California Natural Resources Agency, Division of Oil and Gas, and they discussed basically their oversight of the project, mainly the piers themselves, which we don't have jurisdiction over. That's state lands, and then the Natural Resource Agency for the state. And then U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sent us an email comment, and they wanted protection of the sensitive species, again, the tidewater goby, the red-legged frog, and we're going to do some surveys before any future repair work. And the next thing we looked at was consistency with our general plan, coastal land use plan, and basically, under the land use element, it requires that oil and gas use, until it's terminated, associated facilities shall be designed to reduce environmental impacts. Again, no enlargement of the road, so we're in conformance with that measure. Open space element requires that the access road does not interfere with coastal access. And again, the road will stay in place. You can still access the beach and go up and down the coast south of the roadway. And then the conservation element requires that the access road activities protect ESHA. As you can see, we have a lot of measures to protect ESHA within this project. Zoning consistency, this is a non-conforming land use. Again, we're in the recreation zone. So there can absolutely be no enlargement or extension of this roadway. And this project does not contemplate that at all and is not proposing to enlarge the facility. So we're in conformance with that. Coastal Act consistency. Until the city has a certified local coastal program, projects in the coastal zone require California Coastal Commission approval, as I stated previously. And the Coastal Commission staff has recommended approval of the project with five special conditions. That is maintaining the current access road alignment, maintaining the existing footprint of the revetment, hiring a biologist for pre-construction surveys, identifying avoidance measures, requiring biological monitoring during the project work, and installing construction fencing to prevent impacts to adjacent habitats. Again, we've been working closely with the staff at the Coastal Commission, and we have the same conditions, so we're totally in alignment with them. The Coastal Commission staff report also identifies Coastal Act consistency with the incorporation of these five special conditions. So they can make their Coastal Act findings. The project is actually going to be considered at a hearing on March 9th, so next Wednesday. And they're awaiting our action here before they take their action. So in summary and conclusion, all the project impacts can be mitigated to less than significant. The access road and repair project is consistent with the general plan, the coastal land use plan. The project is consistent with the coastal zoning ordinance, as I pointed out. And the project will require a coastal development permit from the Coastal Commission, again, on March 9th. Based upon all this work, all these findings, all these conditions, the mitigation measures, we are recommending that you adopt the final mitigated negative declaration, adopt the mitigation monitoring and reporting program, which has the biological conditions, and approve the development plan and coastal development permit. Thank you, and we're available for any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Commission. I wanted to clarify one point, and that is when Jerry was talking about jurisdiction on the piers and whether or not we do or don't,
We do actually have jurisdiction over a portion of the piers. I think he's referring to the caissons, so that the caissons that are around the wells themselves are under the state's jurisdiction and not in the city. And I also wanted to introduce Keith Wennell from Benico, the applicant. So he's here in the audience and may want to clarify any points, or I just wanted you to know that he's here as a resource if you have questions. And that concludes staff presentation.
Okay. So, Mr. Wennell, did you want to talk to us at all before we go the next steps?
I don't have any presentation for you. I think the staff's done a good job with their MND and their staff report. But I'm here to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you. So do we have any ex parte declarations that we need to do here before we get into discussion? Go ahead, Commissioner Maynard.
I spoke briefly with Dr. Ingeborg Cox this afternoon. She reiterated things that she submitted in her comments, so I didn't get any particularly new information. She did give me a couple of additional maps that I made a copy of for staff in case there's interest in that. But it is very consistent with what was in the report and the comments that she submitted.
Commissioner Fuller?
No.
Okay. Commissioner Daniels? Any ex parte?
No, sir.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I visited the site with Ann Wells and the applicant.
And I'll say that I have been to that site area many times, but did not do a visit with the applicant or with staff. All right. So now we have our opportunity. We have no requests to speak on this item, but we have the opportunity for the commission to ask any questions of the staff or the applicant's representative. Does anyone have anything they'd like to bring forward? Commissioner Maynard?
So our first question, can you talk a little bit why we are reviewing some repairs that have been done in the past? What does it mean to approve something that's already been done?
Well, so we're approving the past work because after we, you know, did our due diligence checks mm-hmm. with the Coastal Commission and with the applicant, mm-hmm. We better understood what they did and when. Mm-hmm. So we're doing after-the-fact permitting, similar to like when you would issue an emergency permit, you do mm-hmm. after-the-fact permitting. So we're treating it that way. As we had said, there was never any permit. And so it was one of those little those little things that slipped through the cracks as far as all the agencies mm-hmm. thought the other agencies had the permits. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until last year that we, when we did a record search mm-hmm. With the state, that we found that there was none. So that's why mm-hmm. we're doing an after-the-fact permit and mm-hmm. Feel that that's appropriate for the situation. Mm-hmm. And feel like we get good information from the applicant about when they did work. Mm-hmm. And that this is the appropriate way to move forward.
What are our options in an after-the-fact permitting? It's we can't stop work from happening because it's already happened. It seems an odd situation to go back and look at past work. And I mean, I guess I'm, and maybe I don't know if the applicant wants to speak to this, but like, why didn't the applicant seek a permit in this case? I'm not quite sure I understand that.
You still on? Why didn't we seek an applicant? Because we've been doing the same thing that's been done to the road for the last 50 years, I think is the answer. That's not the best answer, mm-hmm. but it's the only answer. Previous owners of that facility didn't have permits for the road to do work on the mm-hmm. road either, okay. and we simply continued to do the same thing.
Okay.
That's it.
I appreciate that honest response. Thank you.
Sure.
What are our options with them? Like, if we disagree with work in the past, if we don't approve it, well, we can't stop something that's already happened. So I guess I'm not quite sure what my options are as a planning commissioner.
So I think you're absolutely right. You can't stop something that already happened. and I guess we could look at violations, all mm-hmm. those kinds of things. But the fact is that our permits also require that they have daily inspections at those wells.
Mm-hmm.
And so given that our permits require that,
mm-hmm.
yet they don't state that they need permits and they need to notify us for work on the road. We decided to work together to remedy the situation moving forward and looking back. So we did an exhaustive search to look at, did they ever go beyond that 12-foot limit?
Mm-hmm.
Did they encroach on those wetlands? So we did a lot of work on that, and they didn't. So that was the call that we made, and we feel that it's the right one for the situation.
Does this set any precedents for folks not doing permitting in the future? I guess that's another
concern. No, it does not.
Okay. Okay, I have a couple of specific questions about the project. So it's been said in a lot of the presentations that there will be no expansion of the project, but I didn't actually see that specifically laid out in the document. Was that in there that I missed, that it actually says specifically in the proposal that it cannot be expanded?
I believe it does. I'm trying to think where it does. It's okay. In the mitigated negative declaration, because we talk about using fencing to keep the road in its current alignment and not allow any expansion into the wetlands or any sensitive habitat.
Okay. I guess one general comment. There was a description that essentially said that some of this would be considered new construction, I think because of some of the grading elements. Can you talk a little bit about what would be considered new construction within the repairs?
I don't think it would actually be new construction. We would classify it more as repair or maintenance activities, but if you had a pothole, you would have to bring on new materials because the materials would have maybe eroded away.
Okay.
So that's the only thing that would occur. It wouldn't be anything beyond that.
I think it was on page 149 of the big pages. It says the project is defined as new development in the general plan, so I'm trying to better understand that. And which aspects of it would be new development. So it's 149, land use element, and the consistency statement.
I can clarify while he's looking at the page number, but the new development is we're not looking at this. We are looking at this as new development since 2001. So we're bundling it all together, but it was work that was already done and work that will be continued because they need to do the work in order to get to the pier. So it's new development because we did not issue a permit in 2001.
Okay, and if we issue this, will there be any new development or just repairs between now and moving forward the next 5 years?
Literally just repairs and maintenance, as the Coastal Commission also is mandating that there be no additional work beyond that 12-foot existing road surface.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Okay, so on page 10, where it talks about the APCD conditions, the particularly APCD conditions B, which starts on page 9 and continues on page 10, it says that we'd stay compliant with the requirements, but I noticed in the comment letter they gave a set of requirements and suggested control activities, and I'm wondering if the project would also be held to the suggested control activities or just the requirements.
Yes, they definitely would.
Okay.
And because there would be air pollution control district oversight, and they would strictly look at those.
Wonderful. Okay. Sorry, I'm kind of going through my notes as we go through here. Okay, you answered that one for me. Thank you. On page 120. Maybe I'll say a more general comment. So there's a couple of comments, areas where it talks about the riprap and the seawall. And I guess something that I would have liked to see in the comparison with the general plan was referring back to the sections of the general plan that talk about seawalls, and I didn't see that comparison and compliance. So I would have liked to see that. In particular, I would have liked to see safety element 3.7, which has standards for coastal armoring and requirements for applications. And on that one, it says any proposal for installation or repair and maintenance of coastal armoring. So it specifically includes a repair and maintenance. And it says that there must be an alternative analysis, even in a repair situation, to show that the proposed armoring is the least environmentally damaging alternative. Has that type of analysis been done, or would we? Is that something that would come up when that type of repair was happening?
So as we said, the road and the revetments existing, and we did, and the mitigated negative declaration doesn't require that we do alternatives analysis. But I also wanted to point out, if they came in and asked for a permit for a seawall or a revetment in that zone district, we would deny it because it would be a non-conforming use. So we didn't use those policies because we didn't think that they applied, because this is legal non-conforming. So someday it won't be there because it's not supposed to be there under our land use designation and zoning. So that was the reason why we didn't use those policies.
I guess I'm concerned just because we do actually have specific language about repair of seawalls in the general plan. It seems like we should be compliant with that, whereas the overall project is non-conforming use. That's something we could still hold to in the general plan. So I'll leave that as a comment. And let me see if I had anything else that wasn't addressed in the presentation here. So there is any of what the road repairs, would that be considered grading, or what the types of road repairs you're doing are too minor? They wouldn't get to the level of grading.
You're correct. That would be too minor and would not be considered grading.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying. And we don't need that. Okay. I think those are my questions for right now.
Commissioner Fuller.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, just one, you know, that leaves me a little unclear, because going back to 149, when it talks about the project is defined as new development, includes grading, removing, dredging, mining, or extraction of any materials, where if this is not grading, then, you know, there's no extraction of materials, there's no dredging, there's no mining. You know, any materials would, of course, mean that if there was, you know, any amount done at all, you know, like if you used your hand and scooped something, you know, you'd be need a negative declaration. But if grading isn't, then I don't see what in that definition is.
Right. We were just taking a very conservative approach. But with all the mitigation measures, all the conditions to keep them in their current alignment, it's not technically, it's technically new, but it's not going to be enlarged or extended. So it's just semantics, really.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Mr. Chair, a couple of minor things, but typos, which I won't get into. But I did have a question for staff and the applicant on my site visit. And I understand the history of this structure, and Venico has kind of adopted what's there, and they weren't the original applicant, they weren't the original people who built it. But my question was, is there any, in any historical document or in the reclamation plan, I assume there's a reclamation plan for the EOF, did that at all include the road? So is there, you know, and I can think of a million reasons why we shouldn't touch the road when the oil and gas, you know, use is done. And then I could think of a million reasons maybe to do it. So I'm just curious if staff has addressed any reclamation.
So first, let me separate out the 421 facilities, the piers, and the access road, and the Elwood Onshore facility. Those two facilities are separate. They are, the Elwood Onshore facility is getting product from Platform Holly, which is offshore. And the piers at 421 is a small field that's offshore, right there off the ends of the piers at the caissons. But so it's very small. And it does not, that oil would not, has not, does not get processed at the Elwood Onshore facility. It is piped separately into pipeline line 96. So they're two very different facilities. Reclamation plan, We had, after our exhaustive search, we have not found one for the piers or the access road.
Okay. All right.
Any other questions? Commissioner Jacobs?
No, thank you.
Commissioner Daniels?
It was interesting to see the 1920 picture image with all those piers. I hear you. You're not going to extend the piers, but who would be the regulatory or who would have regulatory
over the piers or regulatory over which?
Over the extension of the piers. Would that be Coastal Commission?
So if I think I understand what you're saying. If there was to be work on the caisson walls or at the piers or recommissioning of the piers, then that is a separate project. It's mm-hmm. not related to this, and that would be subject to an entirely different type of evaluation from the city and an entirely different kind of environmental document, which would relook at the access road, and because the pipelines that would then be used for the piers, the product to get to the processing facility, wherever that might be, would be in the road, and so that would have to all be relooked at. That's a separate project and be jointly reviewed by many agencies, including the city.
Mm-hmm.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it was just it was just a question, and so from that black and white image, it seemed reasonable to go out and do it again, and all of it's non-conforming.
Yeah, it's all non-conforming, which is why our general plan has it as non-conforming, mm-hmm. because the vision in the general plan is to return that to its natural state.
Right. Understood. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one little bit of housekeeping on page 020, the big one. It just lists under the adoption the Commissioner Daniels as the chair of the City of Goleta Planning Commission.
Okay.
Well, the clerk will. They always scrub the resolutions and make sure that all those little details are corrected. But thank you for pointing that out. Mm-hmm. Right, Linda.
Mr. Fuller.
One last comment. I'm sure that the applicant has gone through great expense with this, but typically, in my understanding of in the past, permitting things that have already happened, there's usually been like a penalty or like double permit fees or something, like in the city of Santa Barbara. Is there, I'm sorry to put an extra burden on the applicant, but is there a penalty involved here for, their past activities and not coming and obtaining permits, which they may not have known they needed, but,
Thank you. We're not looking at a penalty situation. A lot of it's because we have it in our own permit conditions that they utilize that access road, and that even that they notify us if the access road is not passable, because mm-hmm. it's that important for them to get to the piers mm-hmm. and look at the wells. So that's the reason that we didn't feel that there was anything done that was with malintent. It was literally an error long ago in the permit process. It was probably not even error. It was just the way they did things way back then, and we're catching up to that now and correcting that, and they've been working with us to do so.
So the past repairs were to accommodate conditions that they that were already imposed on them.
Right. Okay. Commissioner Maynard.
So thinking a little bit about that, is there a clear expectation that if a permit wasn't sought in the future that there would be a penalty, or how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Well, if we get a permit, it will be our first permit, mm-hmm. and so we will actually be able to go out mm-hmm. and make site visits and mm-hmm. send out monitors and do all mm-hmm. these and do inspections. Mm-hmm. do it officially and work with the applicant. So we'll actually have better eyes and ears on the site than we do now. So I think we'll, and better reporting mechanisms and tools.
Another question. I know we're adding a lot of heavy equipment to the roadway that was built mostly with fill. And so has there been, was that one of the things that was looked at, is what whether the weight of the equipment going onto that road would disturb the soil underneath it? Or I know there's at least one pipeline that runs through there. So is there any concerns there?
Thank you. This activity that we're permitting is no different than what's been done over the past 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So we're confident that it won't hurt the infrastructure below, and that we're okay with having this equipment on the road at this point.
And Mr. Weddle can clarify if I get this wrong, but there's no active, there's no product in any of the lines. So the lines are all cleaned out. So and before they would ever restart or reuse anything, they would inspect those lines, of course.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion.
Okay, I think at this point, do we close public hearing? Okay, before I accept your motion, I'm going to close the public hearing. And we're back to the commission for deliberations. And if your desire is to go directly to motion, please go ahead.
Well, maybe it'll prompt some deliberation on the motion. I would adopt Planning Commission Resolution 16, next in line, entitled A Resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Goleta, California, adopting the final mitigated negative declaration, adopting the mitigation monitoring and reporting program, and approving the development plan and coastal development permit for the PRC 421 Access Road Maintenance and Repair Project, case number, which I won't read, State Oil and Gas Lease Number PRC 421 Access Road, which is on APN, which I won't read, Sandpiper Golf Course, and another APN for the Elwood Onshore Facility.
Second.
We have a first and a second. Any other discussion?
I would like to make an amendment. I would like to amend that I'm okay adopting the final mitigated negative declaration. However, I do believe for the latter two parts, adopting the mitigation monitoring and reporting program and approving the development plan and coastal development permit, that I do think that they should be in compliance with safety element 3.7, which does determine guidelines for repair and maintenance of coastal armoring. And I do believe that the reporting plan should explicitly state that no expansion of these facilities will be there.
Well, that creates a little bit of a challenge. How do we deal with that? We've got a motion and a second on the floor, unless the makers of the motion would want to amend their motions to accommodate your recommended amendments. And, of course, those amendments may have more complexity to them than it appears on the face, but... I guess here's what I'll do. I'll put it back to the makers of the motion, whether they would like to entertain the opportunity to add the recommended amendments suggested by Commissioner Maynard.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that opportunity. I believe in our question and answer time, I think the question was posed to staff, and I think from my perspective, they adequately answered it. And so I'm not prepared to amend my motion unless the second is having great thought on this issue.
I am not.
Okay. All right. So then we're going to vote on the motion as presented, unless there's any further discussion.
If I could just make a couple comments. It seemed to me that there was specifically no work to be done on the seaward side of the revetment and seawall there, and so therefore the armor protecting is not part of this permit. Is that correct? If I can get up. Well, that's I don't know if we're opening this up again, so I'll just say that that was my impression in reading it, was that, you know, they weren't actually permitting any, you know, additional work, you know, to the seaward side where the seawall would be or the sea protecting would be. So in, by not addressing, you know, the general plan, it's consistent with that. I'm satisfied that that the road as it is the whole subject of this, and that there's going to be no changes to the road, even if it's, you know, not written out in one specific line there. I'm pretty confident, but that's my opinion. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, any further discussion? The motions are on the floor. The motion is to approve the staff recommendation as listed in our packet. Any further discussion? If not, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed, and I just like
not,
it.
Not opposed.
I'm opposed, and I do want to thank both the applicant and the staff today, that I came in with a number of concerns about this proposal, and most of my concerns were addressed. My remaining concern is inconsistency with safety element 3.7. I would like that noted.
Okay, so now that I've taken the vote and had your comment, it looks like it passes 4-1. Okay, so we'll move on to the next item. All right, discussion item B1. Madam Clerk,
yes.
Did you want to read that item into the record for us?
Item B1 is a discussion and action item. It's the General Plan Annual Report 2015.
All right. Ms. Wells, Mr. Newkirk, you're here for us tonight. Is the commission all right to continue here, or do you need a break? I don't see anybody jumping up, so we're going to keep going.
Good evening, Chair and Commissioners. Tonight's item before you is a requirement under Government Code 65400, and it requires that the planning agency, which is a combination of the City Council and the Planning Commission, send a general plan annual report to the state by April 1st each year. The Planning Commission is required to make a recommendation to the City Council on the implementation of the general plan, and that's by reviewing the report and receiving this presentation. The report is always a collaborative effort. We start usually around November, and we start looking at what we did that year, and then we continue into January and February to get to Planning Commission at around this time, and then we take the item to City Council. And we've been in advanced planning. We can sort of lead the effort, but it really is one of those rare times where you get to go to everybody in City Hall and talk about all the things that they did, looking at each implementation action in the general plan, which there are a number of, obviously. That's why our report is pretty thick. And it's, you know, personally my pleasure just doing this every year, being able to see, you know, what we've accomplished over the year and over the years, and we've really done a lot in 2015. And I think 2016 is going to be even more. But it's even more my pleasure to introduce Andy Newkirk, because I have a partner in crime, so to speak, and somebody to go around to everyone at City Hall with me and make sure that we're getting accurate and up-to-date information and reading staff reports and really taking care to get you some really high-quality, accurate information to consider. So with that, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Andy Newkirk, and he's going to run you through some of the highlights of what's in the annual report.
Chair Onan and fellow commissioners, as Ms. Wells said, this annual report is a requirement of state law that is submitted by April 1st of each calendar year, reporting on the previous calendar year. The way the report is laid out is a provide a status of the general plan, describe implementation progress throughout all the elements, the 10 elements in the general plan. And then some of the bulk at the end of the report looks at the RENA numbers, new housing stock that has occurred over that calendar year. So there's a lot of detail about that housing development in the report. So the general plan amendment status, there are two general plan amendments in 2015, one for Cortona, which were two map amendments, and Old Town Village, which was a land use change. There were no amendments initiated in 2015, so nothing new that came in for the process. There are two pending developer-funded amendments for land use changes for the Shelby Trust and Kenwood Village, and one city-initiated amendment is still out there for the Old Town Park project, which will require a land use change for in Old Town. The first implementation action, and one that you're all well aware of at this point, is preparation and adoption of a new zoning code. So the big marker in 2015 was the release of a public draft zoning ordinance on November 19th. Obviously, as you're well aware, that document is now under review, often at this dais. And I'll note that I won't go through every instance in the report where the zoning new zoning ordinance is mentioned as part of an implementation, but as you'll see in the report, there are many implementations throughout various elements that reference this project. So this project, as is often stated at the Planning Commission workshops for the project, is really looking to implement that general plan in various ways. There are some other zoning-related projects that went on in 2015. One that you've heard references to occasionally is the Local Coastal Program grant, which includes policy and regulatory language. So there, you know, that's following the new zoning ordinance project, but there's one half of the Local Coastal Plan is an implementation plan, which is regulation. There's also a nonconforming use termination ordinance that was heard at City Council and adopted in January of 2015, and that's getting folded into the new zoning ordinance, as well as housing element-related regulations and definitions, which was adopted by City Council on March 3rd, and those definitions and regulations and procedures are also getting folded into this new zoning ordinance project. The open space element, in 2015, the City Council approved a recreational needs assessment, and since that May approval, that document has been with the Parks and Recreation Commission, and they're going through the recommendations and prioritizing those recommendations that were found in that needs assessment. The future Old Town Park was also in progress in 2015. A design was presented to the Parks and Recreation Commission and City Council in 2015. There have been a few holdups in the development of that park, but that design was done in 2015, and you can see the on the right there is a skate park design that you'll be seeing in the Old Town Park. There's also a lot of work done on Elwood Mesa, including the Butterfly Docent Program. There's ongoing open space maintenance. The Elwood Trails and Habitat Restoration Project is still ongoing, and there is scrub and oak woodland restoration being done in 2015 out on the mesa. Conservation element, one of the implementation actions was a greenhouse gas reduction plan. That plan, which is referred to as a climate action plan, was adopted in 2014, but there were several actions that took place in 2015 related to reductions in energy use within the city. A few to note, our City Council authorized staff to participate with Santa Barbara County in the first stages of the feasibility study for community choice energy. City Council also adopted an ordinance streamlining solar permits for residential uses. And a water efficiency landscaping ordinance was also adopted, or was developed in 2015 and was eventually adopted by City Council in February of this year. And some of that language is also getting considered as part of the new zoning ordinance project. In the safety element, one of the implementation actions is the annual oil and gas safety audits, and this is more specifically referring to the Elwood Onshore facility. At the end of 2014, there were 45 audit findings outstanding that required some kind of remedial action. As of February 12, 2015, those findings had been remedied. Typically, this audit occurs in late fall. There was no audit done because this year because of the EOF being shut down due to the pipeline issues in the region. Safety element impact or implementation action 4, multi-hazard emergency response plan. City adopted a plan in 2012. At the end of 2015, work got underway for an update to that plan. Those plans get updated from time to time to adjust for new issues that arise. And a new plan is expected to be completed in 2016. So that's something to look forward to. The transportation element, one of the main implementation actions is the capital improvements program and budget. So currently, the program includes 48 projects with an estimated cost of $196 million. The two sets of images here are for two projects that were completed in 2015. So these are still in the construction phase, but the Los Carneros overhead bridge replacement is obviously a really large project that got completed in the 2015 time period. Currently, there's 30 active projects with an estimated cost of $40 million. There's only a couple active projects, but there's a lot in the design phase right now, several for pedestrian access and movement, and also bicycle trails and bikeways. And so these are two images of two of these projects in the design phase, one for the street network in Old Town, and on the right for the San Jose Creek bike path project. So that's, they've broke it up into different segments, and those are two of the segments of that project. A lot of the report focuses on the housing element. The housing element is a fairly long element. And so we've highlighted just a few activities that went on in 2015. HE 1.3 seeks to monitor and preserve assisted affordable housing. Just wanted to highlight this project. Villa Esperanza in Old Town went through the planning process, and there's going to be demolition, rebuilding, and extensive remodeling at that facility. The net will be 8 new affordable units. They've taken some of their multi-bedroom units, and they're breaking them into smaller units to meet the needs that are out there today. As part of that project, they utilized the density bonus. The density at that site is 16 units per acre. They've gone up to 16.7, so modest increase over the density maximum. But through the density bonus, they were able to get that, and they also got reductions in common open space and parking as part of that density bonus. HE 1.4 seeks to preserve mobile home parks and facilitate mobile home park ownership. Activities that occurred in 2015 were the development of a mobile home closure ordinance to provide some protection for residents in mobile home parks. That was developed in 2015 and eventually adopted at City Council in February 2nd, 2016. HE 2.1 encourages a diverse range of new housing, looking at all kinds of different special needs, different types of housing to accommodate the needs of the community. An example project that does have different types of housing is the Old Town mixed-use project, which includes 34 live-work units and 28 shopkeeper units. So that's an example of a project that supports HE 2.1. HE 2.8 includes funding for affordable housing. So there's a housing in lieu fund that the city maintains. The existing balance is just under $2 million, up about $450,000 from last year. Two deposits for Harvest Hill Residential Project and Rincon Palms Hotel Project. And there was one expense from that fund in 2015 to support the South Coast Workforce Home Buyer Program. HE 5.1 includes housing element updates pursuant to state law. This table here represents the regional housing needs allocation that needs to be addressed in those housing element updates. Again, these are numbers. The city has to show capacity for these units. They do not have to have all these units built in the time frame, but show that capacity. And as part of the housing element update process, the city did that, at least the Housing and Community Development at the state found that the city adequately did that. And on March 2nd, 2015, the city received certification of the housing element, which is the first time the city has a certified housing element. A little summary of the development, the housing development that went on in 2015. The final 69 units at Haskell's received their certificates of occupancy. Five of those units were restricted to moderate income. Another five, which you won't see in the HCD reporting tables, were for a Goleta-specific income restriction for workforce housing, which is 120 to 200% moderate median income. And HCD doesn't have that category, so that's something the city has opted to do. So you won't see that in some of the tables. But so there's five moderate and five of the city's workforce above moderate category. The first 134 units of West Star have been occupied, and the remaining units are Hollister Village. The remaining units are under construction. There's more than 1,300 units in the permit processing. So still several large developments in different phases at this point, and the biggest ones are listed there for your reference. So some of the implementation highlights: there are two general plan amendments. The new zoning ordinance project is well underway. The city received a certified housing element for 2015 to 2023. The recreation needs assessment was approved by city council. We saw the completion of the Los Carneros Bridge replacement project, and there are several projects under construction and many more that are listed in the report in the design phase as part of the capital improvement program. So what staff is seeking tonight is adopting the resolution recommending city council approval and submittal to both OPR, the Office of Planning Research, and HCD Housing and Community Development at the state. And we are available for any questions you may have.
Thank you.
And I'd just like to point out that the collaborative effort is alive right now. We have a public works director in the audience. And of course, our planning and environmental review director is here. So if you have questions, feel free. And thank you.
All right. So let's go to the commission for any questions that they might have of staff. Mr. Daniels, any questions for staff?
No, it seemed very, very, very good.
Thank you. Andy, thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins.
Just one, Mr. Chair. The housing element 2005, we list 1,300 units in the permitting process. Do all those have water entitlements with the Goleta Water District?
Yes, they do. Not only one doesn't have enough water, but yes, they all do.
Okay, thank you.
Now, I just want to also clarify, half that list is either has been entitled mm-hmm. and the other half is still moving through the process. So there's building permit processing and planning permit as well. It's all included.
Do we allow projects to continue in their application process if Goleta Water District doesn't grant the entitlement?
Currently, no. The project that we're talking about right now has been in the pipeline for years.
Okay.
That's the only reason why it's moving
okay.
forward.
Got it. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Commissioner Fuller?
If I might, just I'm interested in the Goleta Sidewalk Network project. Where is that? Where is it going? And since I have an opportunity here to ask.
Hi, Rosemarie Gaglione, Public Works Director. The Old Town Goleta Sidewalk infill project it's in the preliminary engineering stages. We received an active transportation programming grant of around $2.5 million, and that kicks in July 1, when we can really dig into the design, finish that up, and begin construction.
Great. Thank you.
Anything else?
I'm good, thank you.
Commissioner Maynard.
When will the next safety audit be done of the EOF?
I'm not sure. Typically, the audits are done in November, mm-hmm. but since they're shut down, mm-hmm. We're doing inspections, so mm-hmm. there's a number of inspections and drills and even mm-hmm. unannounced drills, mm-hmm. But there's everything, since everything's shut down, mm-hmm. In order to do the audit, you have to start up equipment, so... Mm-hmm. That's subject to whether or not the All-American pipeline is up and running and they have somewhere to transport their product.
Thank you for that clarification. I have another question. In the one of the things that we didn't have action on last year was the preparation of a creek and watershed management plan. And are there any expectations of when that might get picked up again?
We don't have the creek and watershed protection plan as of yet on our radar. That we still have, we're still finishing San Jose Creek, and that's an important project for our creek flows and flooding. So we're first doing that before we start off, embark on that big journey of our creek and watershed plan.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification on that. Those are all my questions.
All right. So I see no other questions from the commission. So it looks like the staff is looking for a recommendation from us that will allow them to transmit this report to the state. So we'll entertain a motion to do so or not do so on the commission's pleasure. Would anyone like to make a motion?
I'll make a motion to move forward with this report.
Is that adopting the staff recommendation?
Yes, it is adopting the staff recommendation.
Second.
We have a first and a second on adopting the staff recommendation as stated in our packet. Any further discussion? Seeing none, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Looks like it's unanimous, so we won't look for the rest of them. All right. Thank you very much for that. So let's go on to our final few items for this evening's festivities. Our director's report.
It'll be very short. Since we did not have a continuance to a date certain tonight for the cell item, you have next Monday off, so enjoy it. We're back on March 14th with the next set of zoning chapters to review, and we will be posting all of those online and in the notices that go out in the email alerts. Speaking of alerts, those of you who are listening, watching your phones, there was just a it was a test alert from OEM that went out on Nixle that called for a tornado watch. And then they immediately turned around and sent out, this was just a test. So don't panic, it's all fine. I was like, what? So other than that, that was all I had tonight. Thank you for your work tonight. I know putting three significant items on an agenda is makes things go a little long, but thank you for being willing to be here as many weeks as we've been doing zoning. Oh, also, we had an all-city, all-day workshop on Saturday for the zoning ordinance. We had really good attendance. All planning staff were here for it, and we were able to connect with different members of the community. Our chair came very early in the morning, so it was great to see you, and it was a good day. So that's all.
All right, commissioner comments. Anybody have any comments? No, I will say that I did get to attend the workshop, and it was well staffed. I think you said pretty much you had the whole planning department here with multiple stations accommodating those people who were coming in. And just to the group, good work tonight. I mean, that first subject was difficult, and you dug into all the details and took an action that obviously everyone felt needed to be done in that case. So good work. Yes, Commissioner Maynard.
I also just want to acknowledge and thank staff. Looking at the general plan update today, it is absolutely evident the amount of work that you've done over the past year. So thank you for all of your efforts.
Okay, with nothing further, this meeting is adjourned.